All right, Daniel chapter 4. And like I said, when when we're done with this, you will have a notebook with 63 pages altogether. The vision of the great tree. And by the way, this is the last chapter that we have Nebuchadnezzar in person. He's referred to later on, but he's not a player. Now, this chapter is a little different in that the speaker is Nebuchadnezzar. If you have a Bible that the first word of each chapter is all in caps, this is going to be one of the longest chapters that you have, or longest intros. You've got those in Daniel because chapter 2 works the same way, or chapter 3 works the same way. It starts out with Nebuchadnezzar, which is quite a mouthful. Nebuchadnezzar the king, unto all people, nations, languages that dwell in all the earth, peace be multiplied unto you. So he starts out with an official proclamation. And he's going to be sharing something. And I know there's a number of folks that disagree with me. I think that he is sharing basically his personal testimony of how he came to recognize the God of heaven. He says, I thought it good to show you the signs and wonders that the high God hath wrought toward me. How great are his signs, and how mighty are his wonders. His kingdom is an everlasting kingdom, and his dominion is from generation to generation. One of the things that's very interesting in chapter 3 is we dealt with, and we will deal with in this chapter, with the arrogance of Nebuchadnezzar. He has two issues. He has arrogance and he has anger. If you have a man who is, at least in his own eyes, all-powerful, and somebody steps in there and challenges that, that arouses the anger of the person who perceives themselves to be all-powerful. You have a man that built an empire almost single-handedly. Babylon was a very, very old city when he came on the scene, but he built this city huge. The walls around the city were double walls. It was a 17-mile circumference around this city, and that was his doing. There were 49 major building projects that we're aware of that he did, and that was toward the second half of his reign. Just a remarkable fellow. And was it Carlyle, I think, emphasized the fact that his personal view is that history is made by great men. And to a large extent, that's true. And Nebuchadnezzar was one of those great men. He talks about all these things, but here's something that's interesting. It doesn't matter whether we're talking about Queen Victoria. It doesn't matter whether we're talking about Elizabeth I. It doesn't matter whether we're talking about Louis the 14th. It doesn't matter whether we're talking about Peter the Great or Frederick the Great or any of those other great guys. It doesn't matter whether we're talking about Nebuchadnezzar or Julius Caesar or anybody. Guess what? All those guys have something in common. They're dead. All right? And it doesn't matter how great the person is. It doesn't matter how noble they were, how great a leader they were. They're still going to die. And I think Nebuchadnezzar, remember, he's writing this after the events that'll be described in the chapter. This intro is written after the fact. And so he mentions that his kingdom is an everlasting kingdom and his dominion from generation to generation. Nebuchadnezzar was succeeded by a guy who, there's different ways of pronouncing it and spelling it, but it basically, Amel Marduk. You can't read it anyway. And he was not anything to be excited about. He only ruled for a couple of years and he was assassinated. And you had a succession in just a few years of two or three kings before Nabonidus came on the throne and ruled for a number of years. And the empire declined thereafter. The empire was Nebuchadnezzar. Something that Solomon says regarding all the things that he builds, and I will leave them to someone who will follow me, and who knows whether he will be a wise man or a fool. What will he do with what I leave to him? Who knows what he will be like? I don't know. I just do the best I can, but I'm going to go, and I will leave this to somebody else. He says here, though, in verse 3, that in reference to God, his kingdom is an everlasting kingdom, and his dominion from generation to generation. You know, over 2,500 years ago, when Nebuchadnezzar was on the throne, so was God. And 150 years ago, when Victoria was on the throne, so was God. And 2,100 years ago, not quite even that long ago, when Julius Caesar was on the throne, so was God. And we can go through all these great, sometimes not very great, men and women who ruled, and they're all gone. And God continues to rule. Because God has no successor, because God doesn't die. God, if you want to say this, is his own successor. And therefore his kingdom does not end. And Nebuchadnezzar recognizes that. He recognizes the fleeting idea of his own. We go back to chapter 2, we have the image. And Nebuchadnezzar, he is told, will be succeeded by something else. And they'll be succeeded by something else. And they'll be succeeded by something else. And they'll be succeeded by something else. And then they will be succeeded by this kingdom that simply expands a little bit. Because this is a kingdom that never ends. So, he begins the story in verse 4. I, Nebuchadnezzar, was at rest in mine house and flourishing in my palace. That word flourishing, I think it's very descriptive. This is fairly common in a lot of languages. It means literally to make, I'll go a little slower and make the letters clearly, make green. I was flourishing. Like a plant that's really taken off. I'm just, you know. I was flourishing in my palace. You can put that in your next Christmas letter. I was flourishing this past year. And he has a dream. Now everything's going great in verse 4. We'll get to the end, toward the end, and he's going to have the same attitude. Everything is great. I mean, I built this huge empire. I have on my borders nobody that is willing to challenge. The last 20 years or so of his reign were relatively peaceful because no one that was even close was willing to challenge him. He had this big empire. He took it about as far as he cared to go. He even conquered part of Egypt and then left it after he'd sacked it because I didn't want to take you and incorporate you into the empire. I just want to take all your goodies. I've got enough, thank you. I built this monstrous huge city where I am flourishing. I have a palace. I have these beautiful gardens. I've just got everything a heart could desire and more. And I did it all. That's his attitude. I was flourishing. And I had a dream. And now, understand, it's been probably close to 30 years since chapter 2. All right, this is toward the end of his reign. He reigned for 43 years. He had not been on the throne very long when chapter 2 came in. Remember, he was the general of the army, and he was out building the empire while his dad sat on the throne and, you know, minded the store. He was building the empire and doing all these great things while his dad was going, wow, and said, hey, that's my boy, you know, while his boy is doing all the work. And so this is toward the end of the, three quarters into his reign. He has a dream. And you would think that a dream of this perplexing nature and so on is going to bring back a remembrance of what had happened some 30 years before. Where he's honored, he's flattered perhaps by the head of gold. But there's always the reminder, you will be succeeded. You will be succeeded. You will be succeeded. Doesn't matter what you build, you'll be succeeded. I had a dream. Which made me afraid, even the likes of Nebuchadnezzar afraid. And the thoughts upon my head and the visions of my head troubled me. And therefore he calls for all the wise men like he did back in chapter 2. And I find this very interesting. Look at verse 7. Then came the magicians and the astrologers and the Chaldeans and the soothsayers. And I told the dream to them. He's not pulling the same thing that he did back in chapter 2 where he says, all right, you tell me the dream and the interpretation. Tell me the dream. Tell me the interpretation. He says, but they did not make known unto me the interpretation thereof. It doesn't say they could not. I think that piecing the things together, and you can read it. You'll read about the dream in just a moment. I think they were afraid. because this does not bode well for the king. And we don't want to give the king bad news. Remember, he's temperamental. And if we give him bad news, we talked about this morning. Tell me smooth things. Tell me things I want to hear. Don't give me any bad news. Just tell me what I want to hear. Whether it's true or not, I don't care. Just tell me what I want to hear. Nebuchadnezzar is not like that, though. People who are willing to listen to lies and believe them don't stay in power like he has. I want it all, good and bad, so I can deal with it. And the wise men did not reveal it to him. Doesn't say could not. Said they did not. Now, verse 8. Believe it, it's kind of funny. I've mentioned this from time to time. When you read the commentaries, what they make a great deal out of it to me is hilarious. If Daniel has been able to pull the rabbit out of the hat so many times, why not call him first? But in verse 8, it says, then at the last, but at the last, Daniel came in. Now, why does Daniel come in last? I think there's several possibilities. Let's have some input here. Why do you think Daniel came in last? What's that?
Greater glory for God.
In other words, let the other guys do their thing and be either unwilling or unable to fulfill the king's demand. Okay, another possibility. Now remember, 30 years have gone by and these guys are still have a job. So evidently they had won a little bit of a reprieve and some of the king's confidence to come in and do some of the things that they did.
He was just going to let them show off their idiocy and then he was going to come in.
Okay.
Because he had the answer.
All right. Yes?
He may not have been an initial part of that group.
Okay. That's a very strong likelihood. Daniel was given position / title of chief of the wise men. This doesn't mean that he was, you know, out there leading seminars on how to be a wise man. What was his request at the end of chapter 2? That he sat in the king's gate. That he became part of the court. That he became, you know, somebody who was like the king's right-hand man, his deputy. And so if I'm calling in for the wise men, Daniel's got other responsibilities. He's outside of royalty as far as an enlisted man is concerned. He's the number one guy. He's a busy guy. I woke up for a dream. I'm going to ask these other guys to meet the need. I'm not going to bother this guy because he's busy doing the things I need him to do that nobody else can. I'm only going to call on him if the other guys can't. All right? I got an oil well fire. I only call Red Adair if I run out of other options, okay? Because he's expensive. Daniel's brought in at the last. By the way, I think the other ideas are components of that. But I think the primary one, it has to do with other responsibilities and so forth. You don't bring in the top dog if you know, the chihuahua will do. All right. He says in verse 9, O Belteshazzar, remember this is his Babylonian name, Belteshazzar, master of the magicians, because I know that the spirit of the holy gods is in thee. All right, we get back to the same issue we had last week. It's kind of funny. People get all uptight. Mentioned this last time. And one has the appearance of the son of God. But newer translations say son of the gods. And the King James only people go absolutely bonkers, but who's speaking? Because it can be translated either way. It's a Hebrew plural. Or in this case, in our Aramaic plural, and it works the same way. So in chapter 3, the personage in the furnace, Nebuchadnezzar speaking, says, has the appearance of a son of God, or son of the gods. Here, he says, in the same wording, same words, I know the spirit of the holy gods, plural, is in thee. And this is mentioned several times in this chapter. He could just as easily be meaning the spirit of the holy God is in you. It's a matter of translation, and we don't know which one Nebuchadnezzar means, because understand, you're dealing with a guy who is basically pagan. Now, some lights have come on over the years. I think some lights have come on here in chapter 4. Which way is it? We don't know. Because it doesn't say. But he does know that Daniel, by his own admission, is divinely enabled to do what he does. And it isn't because of the Babylonian gods, it's the God that he worships. Tell me the visions of my dream that I have seen and the interpretation thereof. He asked for both. But it isn't a deep, dark secret as far as the dream because he's already told it to everybody else. And he figures Daniel's going to, either he's heard this or he's going to know anyway because, again, he's got the spirit of his God in him. Thus were the visions of mine head upon my bed. Okay, here's the dream. Because he's going to go ahead and tell him. He's not going to tell Daniel to tell him. He's going to go ahead and spill the beans here. I saw a tree. That doesn't sound terribly exciting. I saw a tree. In the midst of the earth. Let's pause here for just a minute. People nitpick. Earth. The whole earth. All right, from Nebuchadnezzar's perspective, what was the whole earth? His empire and maybe Egypt, maybe the kingdom of the Hittites to the northwest, but basically his kingdom. All right. He's not thinking about Panama and Argentina and South Africa and Australia, all right? He's thinking about what he has knowledge of. That's the whole earth because in his mind, that's all that matters. It's what I've got. How much have I got as a percentage of the whole? I have no idea, but I've got a lot. And as far as he knew, he had basically all of it. Saw a tree in the middle of the earth. And the height thereof was great. It was a big, tall tree. The tree grew and was strong, and the height thereof reached unto heaven. And the sight thereof to the end of the earth. It was so tall, you could see it from virtually anywhere. Remember, Babylon is flat. You don't have any of this in Babylon. It's just, as far as the eye can see, it's just a big flat plain. It's kind of interesting. You're driving across the plains. How many of you have done the Great American Road Trip? You've gone across the country in a car. All right. You'll recognize this if you did this. It doesn't matter day or night. You're driving across the Midwest. Remember, Midwest is like, all right. Or that part of Ontario that dips down in the Great Lakes is also just as flat as the flattest place in Oklahoma. Trust me. And I remember driving across Ontario. And you're 60 miles away. You're 70 miles away. You can see Toronto. Or if you're going the other way, you're 50, 60 miles away, and you can see Detroit. There it is. How can I tell? Because it's all these little bumpy things sticking up out of the horizon. It's the big, tall buildings, because there is no breakup in the horizon other than the buildings. All right. Babylon would have been that to some extent. And that's the image here, is that this tree is this big, tall thing that dominates the horizon. It can be seen. It doesn't matter where you go in the kingdom, you can see it. This huge, tall thing. The tree was, it grew, it was strong. The height thereof reached the heavens. The sight thereof to the ends of the earth. The leaves thereof were fair. Now we're talking about a desert country that has to be irrigated. And the fruit thereof much, and it was meat or food for all. And the beasts of the field had shadow under it, and the fowls of the heaven dwelt in the boughs thereof, and all flesh was fed of it. Everything was dependent on that tree and benefited from the tree. Everything's going great. You got this great big flourishing tree. And it produces shelter, and it produces food and bounty. It says in verse 13, I saw in the visions of my head upon my bed, and behold, a watcher and a holy one came down from heaven. This term, in this kind of context, that word, a watcher, only occurs in this chapter in all the Bible. Now, we have one or two places in pagan literature where this same, of the same era, where this term, or similar era, within a couple of hundred years, where the same word is used. And it refers to, almost certainly what it refers to here. Remember, who's the narrator? Nebuchadnezzar. He's not going to be using the same language that Daniel's going to be using. He's going to be using language that Nebuchadnezzar would be using. So he's going to use terms that are familiar to him. A watcher. Tim McLean to give me penmanship lessons. Remember when he was doing this, man, it was like it was printed on the board. The watcher. What do you think the watcher is? The watcher is a holy one. It isn't a watcher and a holy one, but the watcher is a holy one.
This is angelic here.
All right. We're dealing with somebody who is almost certainly an angel. He comes down from heaven, and he cried with a loud voice and said, "Hew down the tree, cut it down. Get out your Husqvarna and make an end to it. And cut off his branches and shake off all his leaves and scatter the fruit and let the beasts get away from under it and the fowls from his branches." It's all taken away, all gone, all destroyed. But, it says in verse 15, "Nevertheless, leave the stump of his roots in the earth, even with a band of iron and brass, in the tender grass of the herb of the field, let it be wet with the dew of heaven, and let its portion be with the beasts of the grass of the earth, and let his heart be changed into a man's heart, and let it change from a man's heart." That's a key thing. The stump has a man's heart. Remember that. "And let a beast's heart be given unto him, and let seven times pass over him. This matter is by the decree of the watchers, and the demand by the word of the holy ones, to the intent that the living may know that the Most High ruleth in the kingdom of men, and giveth it to whomsoever he will, and setteth up over it the basest of men." This is the dream. What's it mean? Well, Daniel knows. But Daniel, as we have seen back in chapter 2 and in chapter 1, does not necessarily pull a lot of punches. But it says that he was astonished for 1 hour. That doesn't mean, okay, man. Also, I got to get my sundial position just right. And check and see what an hour passed. There was a period of time. Could have been for a couple minutes. Could have been for longer than that. But he's just flabbergasted by this. It isn't that he doesn't know. He knows. I think he's dealing with the same issue that the wise men did, because the wise men probably knew what this meant and were afraid. Daniel has a concern for Nebuchadnezzar. This arrogant, temperamental man has grown on Daniel. He has a love for him. And Daniel is troubled by what the dream means. "And the king spake and said, Belteshazzar, let not the dream or the interpretation thereof trouble thee." Go ahead and tell me. Don't let it bother you. You go ahead and tell me. Now again, you're dealing with a man who know each other probably fairly well. Granted, we're dealing with the king, and we're dealing with a high-end bureaucrat. But at the same time, they have been working together for 30 years. They know each other well. And Belteshazzar, Daniel, answered and said, "My lord, the dream be to them that hate thee, and the interpretation thereof to thine enemies." Wish it was happening to the other guy, is what he's saying. And then he goes ahead and he tells them, starting in verse 20. "The tree that thou sawest, which grew, was strong, whose height reached to the heavens." He's giving a summary. "And the sight thereof to all the earth, whose leaves were fair, and the fruit thereof much, and it was meat to all, under which the beasts of the field dwelt, and upon whose branches the fowls of the heaven had their habitation. It is thou, O king. You're the tree. Thou art grown and become strong. Thy greatness is grown, reaches to heaven. Thy dominion to the ends of the earth," the known earth. "And whereas the king saw a watcher and a holy one come down, saying, cut the tree down, destroy it, and leave the stump of the roots thereof in the earth, even with a band of iron and brass, in the tender grass of the field, and let it be wet with the dew of heaven, and let his portion be with the beasts of the field until seven times pass over him. This is the interpretation. This is the decree of the Most High, which has come upon my lord the king." Now, thus far, he's just reviewed the thing, but he said, "You're the tree." This is the decree of the Most High, which has come upon my lord the king. Verse 25, "They will drive thee from men, and thy dwelling shall be with the beasts of the field. And they shall make thee eat grass as oxen, and they shall wet thee with the dew of heaven. And seven times, we'll come back to that, shall pass over thee, till thou know that the Most High ruleth in the kingdom of men, and giveth it to whomsoever he will. And whereas they commanded to leave the stump of the tree roots, thy kingdom shall be made sure unto thee. When this is all over, you'll still be king. Which is a remarkable thing. We'll come back to that one too. After that, thou shalt have known what the heavens do rule. So, he's going to give him a little counsel here as well, which will let you know how good the rapport was Daniel had with the king. Wherefore, O king, let my counsel be acceptable to thee, and break off thy sins by righteousness, and thine iniquities by showing mercy to the poor, if may be the lengthening of thy tranquility. This isn't going to, let's see if we can put this off. This is going to fix the problem. It's going to happen. But a little repentance goes a long way. And let's see if we can put this off. Now, we get into this. It's it's evident that the king did not heed the counsel. All of this came upon King Nebuchadnezzar. At the end of 12 months, a year goes by from the dream. And he walked in the palace of the kingdom of Babylon. Flat roof building. He's probably up on the roof, looking at the beautiful view, 4, 5, 6 stories up, walking along, looking at the gardens, that magnificent, huge terrace thing that could be seen. The walls of the city were over 300 feet high, and the gardens could be seen from outside the city. It was that magnificent a thing. One of the seven wonders of the ancient world. He built that for his wife, who was from the mountains. Didn't want to live in a flat plain, so we're going to build her own little mountains and forests and so on here. And he's looking at all and saying, yeah, this is pretty nice, isn't it? And you know what? I did it all. I built all this. I gained the wealth. It was my brain. It was my brawn. I did it all. He's taking it all in. He says in verse 30, is not this great Babylon that I have built for the house of the kingdom by the might of my power and for the honor of my majesty? A little self-absorbed, isn't he? Verse 31, while the word was yet in the king's mouth, because he's probably not just thinking this. After all, he's king. He's got all these minions all along behind him, and they're just taking it in. Yes, your majesty. Yes, your majesty. Yes, your majesty. Yes. Yes. And I know it's true because they agree with me. And while this is going on, while the word was in the king's mouth, there fell a voice from heaven saying, O King Nebuchadnezzar, to thee it is spoken, the kingdom is departed from thee. Boom. And they shall drive thee from men, and thy dwelling place shall be with the beasts of the field. And they shall make thee eat grass as an oxen, and seven times shall pass over thee until thou know that the Most High ruleth in the kingdom of men and giveth it to whomsoever he will. The same hour was the thing fulfilled. What happened? All of a sudden, bang, this guy thought he was a cow. Now, there have been, and probably are, lots of people that think that they are animals. This doesn't mean they lose their ability to speak or a number of other interactions, but in their behavior, it's kind of like the little kid who's dressed up in the suit for a school play. He acts the part, but if you ask him a question, he'll still be able to respond to you. But in this case, they really think that they're the animal. Just they can talk. Sometimes. People who have thought themselves to be lions or wolves. Wolves especially have created the idea of the werewolf, because they go out and attack people and so on, because they think that this is what they do. There have been people who have thought themselves to be dogs. There have been people who thought themselves to be cats. There have been people who have thought themselves to be cows. And I think I've got the little note here. A case of this boanthropy. This will be on page 23. If you have the page numbers on the bottom. Last page. A case of boanthropy, which is somebody thinking themselves to be an ox or cow, has been observed. A patient in Britain in the 1940s was of this delusion. Physically, he was in some institution. He was always easy to find. He'd be out in the lawn. Seriously. On his hands and knees. Gardeners probably hated him. Groundskeepers. Physically, the only change was a lengthening of the hair and a coarse, thickened condition of the fingernails. Now, why do you suppose? My wife could probably answer that question. Yeah, the nutrients, the amount of keratin that this person's going to be ingesting is going to cause it. So, you know, guys, we need to go home and start doing that.
Yes.
Think of what we could do. Yeah, I'll have that bushel of hay. There's a lot of keratin in that kind of diet that promotes that kind of thing. And so a real thick, coarse, fingernails, almost like hooves. Years ago, I met a man who was tortured in communist prison camps. And one of the things, I'm not going to go into all the details of what he did, but his hands, his fingernails looked like horse hooves. Really monstrously thick and hard because of some of the things they did to him. He starts, and he's out there grazing. They drive him from men. What's interesting is, but his kingdom is secure. So how is this possible? How's this going to work out? All right, you've got a guy who's been on the throne for over 30 years. A new administration is always a very risky thing. Because you bring a new king and he's going to change things. In your Old Testament, you had King Uzziah, who initially was serving the Lord and so on. But he was very, very successful in war. He was very, very successful as far as commerce is concerned, became very wealthy. The surrounding nations to the east and the south and the west brought him tribute. Very powerful man. And it says his heart was lifted up and he went into the temple to burn incense. And the priests, good for them, went in and said, "It is not for you, King Uzziah, to do this. You're out of line. I know you're king, but you're out of line." And the king got angry. And while the was going on, it says the leprosy sprang up in his forehead. And the priest saw it. And the king became aware of it. And he says the priests were in the process of throwing him out, and he expedited it. "I am out of here." And it said he lived in a separate house for the remainder of his days. Number of years. If you do the chronologies and so on, his son, it says, ruled in his place, ruled the land in his place. But Uzziah's still king. The overlap was something like 14 years or something like that. It's a long time. It's called a co-regency. Smoothness of transition. You don't want to let people know that, hey, the king's gone bonkers and he thinks he's Elsie. All right? You don't want to do that. And so, want to keep it as secret as possible. Maybe word was leaked out here and there that he's on an expedition. Remember, there's no telephones or communications. Everything's word of mouth for the most part. He's on an expedition. There's any number of things that can happen. Plus, he's got Daniel in there. He's got this great administration that's been in place that he has put there over a period of 30 years. He's got key men, loyal people. He's been able to weed out the bad guys and so on. He's got some great folks in there. Keep that machine of state just moving along. He is not necessary to maintain things. Because besides that, he thinks he's a cow. So we're going to keep the ship of state moving along smoothly. His son probably is going to come in, act as co-regent. If somebody needs to see some guy sitting on the throne, it'll be the son. And everything will be fine. What do we do with the guy who thinks he's a cow?
Take care of
him. Yeah. We'll hire the best vet the kingdom has, and we'll get him a fancy corral over here with a high wall that keeps people from peeking in. Now remember, no photographs. How do we know he's the king under normal circumstances? He's wearing robes. If he's buck naked out there grazing on the grass, who in the world's going to know who this guy is? and you get a 12-foot wall around this with maybe 3-4 acres of pasturage in there. We bring in some, by the way, the word there for grass is a general term. It's herbage. So we could bring in some other things. You know, it's like my guinea pigs. They really like lettuce as a treat, maybe some other things, but they like grass too. So we're gonna give him a whole bunch of things, give him a good diet, make sure he's well tended to, because after all, he's the king. There's a loyalty to the man simply because of who he is. Doesn't matter what he's doing or what has happened to him. There's going to be some loyalty. Plus, what was the attitude of the ancients regarding madness? Now, I don't mean somebody who's angry. I'm talking about somebody who is, all right?
He's touched by the gods.
When David was trying to escape, when he was first escaping from Saul, he went to Gath initially. And then he got scared because one of the things he did, because he was in a hurry, he did, wait a minute, I've got Goliath's sword with me. and so they began to talk. Isn't this David that's done this and this and this? And so he says he drooled on his beard and got a piece of charcoal and began drawing pictures on the city gates and stuff and pretended he was mad. And the king said, well, get this guy out of here. Do I have any need of madmen? But we're not going to do anything to him because he's touched by the gods. Therefore, he's protected. So I don't want him around. Keep him away from me, but we can't do anything to him. And therefore, they back off. And when David has his opportunity, he's out of town. Madness was something that was, someone who was, it was charmed, if you want to think about it that way. And therefore, they would be protected because we don't want to offend the gods. Remember, we're dealing with a pagan culture and society. We don't want to offend the gods who have touched this man. And therefore, we need to protect him. But he's also the king, so we can't let the people know what's going on. So we're going to have this class A, you know, thoroughbred kind of a situation where we're going to keep the king as long as this lasts. How long is this going to last? Well, Daniel already told him. Till 7 times pass over. What is that? 7 years. So he's going to be out grazing the North 40 for 7 years. Well, some people are pretty hard-headed. Because this was to last until he recognizes that the Lord is the king. And sets over whom he will. Like I said, this is Nebuchadnezzar's education. And I'll tell you what, the last exam was really tough. They drove him out. And we had this physical change there in verse 33. And at the end of the days, now remember, it says, I, Nebuchadnezzar. Again, we're still dealing with the first person. He's telling the story, which is also letting you know that there's a humbling going on here. He's willing to tell people, yeah, believe it or not, I used to think I was a cow. At the end of the days, I, Nebuchadnezzar, lifted up mine eyes unto heaven. And my understanding returned unto me. When did Daniel say your understanding would return? When you recognized. He recognized his understanding returns. That was the prerequisite. And Daniel told him, well, it's going to be 7 years, by the way. It's going to take you a while to learn the lesson. My understanding returned, and I blessed the Most High and praised and honored him that liveth forever, whose dominion is an everlasting dominion, his kingdom from generation to generation. Going back to the same thing that we had in verse 3. And all the inhabitants of the earth are reputed as nothing, even the likes of Nebuchadnezzar. And he doeth according to his will in the army of heaven. And among the inhabitants of the earth there is none that can stay his hand or say, what doest thou? No one can thwart God. Oh, he said, what did we look at this morning in Psalm 77 and verse 8 in Sunday school hour? Or is verse 76, Psalm 76, verse 10. Surely the wrath of man shall praise thee. The wickedness of men, God turns and manipulates for his own glory. People think they're shaking their fist in the face of God. And defying his will, and yet God takes that very thing and turns it to his purpose. What doest thou? As I please, God says. And at the same time, my reason returned unto me, and for the glory of my kingdom and mine honor and brightness returned unto me. And my counselors and my lord sought unto me, and I was established in my kingdom, and excellent majesty was added unto me. It was just like I went back to like it was before. Now, and by the way, it's interesting. He puts this all in a decree for, in, what's it say there in the beginning? Unto all people, nations, and languages. All the different peoples that are in his domain, he is making a decree to go out and to be proclaimed so everybody knows what has gone on. And this is a very humbling thing for the king, but he's learned his lesson. And who receives the glory? God does. The God of a little defeated nation in the edge of his empire. But he's the God who is. Everything else is the creation of man's hands and imaginations. And there is a God who is. And he is the God of heaven. He's not just the God of Israel. He's the God of heaven. Now I, Nebuchadnezzar, praise and extol and honor the King of heaven, all whose works are truth and his ways judgment, and those that walk in pride he is able to abase. And I've learned my lesson so well that I'm going to tell everybody I can by issuing this proclamation, which is one of the reasons why I think the man was actually converted, acting on the knowledge he had. All right, any further questions or comments on this chapter? Prophecy of a short-term variety. We got a dream. When's it going to happen? It's going to happen next year. How long is it going to last? 7 years. And the whole chapter deals with the prophecy, the fulfillment, and the outcome. Nebuchadnezzar's education. Nebuchadnezzar learned his lesson. Next week, we're going to come across somebody who knew all that Nebuchadnezzar had, or all that Nebuchadnezzar went through, all the details about it, and doesn't learn the lesson. All right, let's close in prayer. Father, we thank you for your word. Father, thank you for opening our eyes. Father, it's not all about us, it's all about you. And Father, thank you for your grace and for your goodness. And Father, thank you for the remembrance, the reminder that you, besides being our Father, are omnipotent and omniscient. And Father, what a blessing that you have. We have a God who loves us, who is our Father. We his children. And we see what goes around us in the world today. And we know that you're in charge, and it will all come to your glory because you turn the wrath of men to your praise and glory. Father, thank you for this. We pray for Christ's sake. Amen.